Hi, I'm Estate Planning Attorney Tom Doyle, and welcome to the podcast presentation of my Tuesdays with Tom teleseminar, The Responsibilities of a Successor Trustee. For more information on the American Center for Estate Planning and the services that we provide, or other Tuesday with Tom teleseminar presentations, please visit us at www.acfep.com. Thank you, and enjoy the presentation.
Thanks again for joining us for this evening's teleseminar, where we're going to be talking about the responsibilities of a successor trustee. If you haven't already looked at the website for my firm, the www.acfep.com, and click on Tuesdays with Tom, you'll see that we have additional teleseminar topics now scheduled through the month of February. I won't reiterate them here, but I invite you to take a look at it and join us for any of the future teleseminars. But tonight we're going to spend a little time talking about the responsibilities of a successor trustee, and I think the place for us to start with that is to at least have some basic understanding about how a trust works. It's important, I think, to have an idea of how a trust works so that you have a better idea of what your job is going to be if you've been appointed the successor trustee, perhaps by your folks or relatives to be managing those. So I basically describe a trust, and we're talking now a living trust. We're going to talk about a couple different kinds, but I basically describe a trust to a client today as think of us building a box. We're going to put this box on the desk, and the box is going to have instructions on it. And the instructions are basically what is to be done with what is inside this box when you pass away. So step one is really building the box, which is what we would talk about as actually creating the trust itself. Step two is what we generally refer to as funding the trust, which is transferring all the various assets that a client has and putting them inside their box. So if they've got real estate, we'll be looking at preparing deeds for their real estate to change the ownership from the client to their trust. Might look at life insurance policy, change beneficiary designations on life insurance policies, look at bank accounts, look at investments, et cetera. And so having a trust itself, when we look at having a living trust, is really the first step. It's the second step, which is the funding the trust, which is often the step that really makes the trust operational, because until there's something inside the box, there's really nothing for the trust to control, because the only thing, the only assets that a trust is going to control are assets that are in fact put inside the box. So if you're looking at a situation where you might be appointed a successor trustee for your folks, your grandparents, something like that, having an understanding that that's what we're really looking at doing and the importance of the funding, I think, is an important first step. Second, important, I think, to have some idea of the understanding of the terminology that we use when we refer to these various trusts. And the three sorts of appointments, I guess, if you will, that we look at or designations that we look at when we have a trust. First, we're going to have the grantor. The grantor, sometimes called the settlor, is the person who creates the trust. So if you were to go out and have a trust created for yourself, you would be considered the grantor of the trust. Second designation is the trustee, and that's what we're really talking about tonight. But the trustee, that's the person who's in charge of it. That's the person who's going to manage it, the person who's responsible for basically taking care of the trust assets, managing the trust assets, and using the trust assets as the trust has designated they are to be used. And the third designation is what we call the beneficiary. That's essentially who gets the benefit of this trust arrangement. With most clients, when they have a living trust created for themselves, They are going to be not only the grantors, they are also going to be the trustees, and they are also going to be the initial beneficiary. So it's very common for the client. They have the trust created for them. They're going to still be in charge of everything, and they're still going to receive all the benefit of it. What we really look at in our documents then is we appoint successor trustees. That is, who's going to be in charge, have the responsibility for managing this trust after the grantor passes away, or oftentimes if the grantor becomes incapacitated and can't manage the assets themselves. And then the other designation we're going to have are the successor beneficiaries, although we normally in a trust just call them a beneficiary. But who's going to get the benefit of this trust after the grantor passes away? Who's going to receive whatever it is that's left in the box after the grantor passes away? So kind of the designations that we look at having, important consideration to have some knowledge of what those designations are. The other thing before we really start talking about the duties of the trustee, understanding a couple different types of trust I think are important for us. We might have what we call a testamentary trust. A testamentary trust is part of a will. It used to be very common when I first started practicing law that when clients would have a will prepared, let's say they had minor children, they might have some provision right in their will itself about if we pass away, assets are going to be held and managed for the benefit of our minor children. That sort of trust, that testamentary trust, only really comes into being, though, once a will is admitted to probate. And so today, many more clients are looking at, well, why don't we have a trust that avoids probate than a trust that requires probate? So the other sort of trust that we look at is what we call a living trust. It's a trust that's created during your lifetime, and it is funded, if you will, during your lifetime, and so that it basically becomes operational during your lifetime. And one of the primary uses of that living trust is to avoid probate. So today, more and more clients are opting for a living trust as opposed to the testamentary trust because not only can we manage assets, but we can also avoid probate at the same time. And then the living trusts themselves, kind of two different flavors, if you will. It might be a revocable trust, meaning it can be changed, it can be amended. In fact, if the grantor wished to, they could get rid of it one day and not have a trust anymore. Or alternatively, we could have an irrevocable trust, which is one that from the time that it was created cannot be changed. Most clients today are going to opt to have a revocable trust so that they have the ability to change that document as circumstances change. Perhaps their wishes change on their successor trustees or their beneficiaries. All of that might be subject to change. Whereas the irrevocable trust has some fairly unique, if you will, places that we're going to be utilizing those oftentimes as part of a federal estate tax planning strategy. We might use them, for example, to hold a life insurance policy. In that event, we're going to call it an irrevocable life insurance trust, or an ILIT for short. We might be using them to create charitable trusts. When we're trying to take care of some federal estate taxes, at the same time taking care of a client's charitable wishes. So irrevocable trust, not the starting point. If you think about it, the basic trust that we're going to be looking at with clients today is going to be the revocable, and then we might have some irrevocable, one or more, depending upon what some other concerns are that we have with the client. Additionally, a revocable trust will become irrevocable when you pass away. So if I have a trust created for myself that it's a revocable trust during my lifetime, I can amend it, I can change it, I can do all those things with it, but upon my death it then becomes irrevocable and can't be changed at that point in time. With that as kind of the background, let's talk about the duties of a successor trustee, because obviously the grantor who also serves as a trustee isn't really concerned about their duties. But we're more concerned today about talking about the duties of a successor trustee. And that successor trustee, quite frankly, might take over a trust during the grantor's lifetime or might be taking over the trust at the time of the grantor's death. Either way, the starting point for if we look to what are the duties, what are the obligations of a successor trustee, those are going to be found in one of two places. One, the trust document itself. That is the controlling document that will oftentimes spell out many of the duties of the successor trustee, what they have to do by way of accountings or notice to creditors or investment management type responsibilities. So it's first and foremost very important that obviously in serving as a successor trustee that you have the trust document and review the trust document because that's going to designate quite a bit of what your duties and responsibilities are. Additionally, the different states have all adopted in general their own laws that might come into play on what are the default duties of a trustee. If a trust doesn't say something different than what the statute provides is going to control, sometimes we'll have legislation in some of the states that control what a trust says, and you can't change that by virtue of the trust. But each of the different states are going to have most likely developed different statutes. Now, some of them are going to be fairly uniform from state to state, but when we're dealing with trusts and we're dealing with the states, that's not a federally controlled activity. It's going to be controlled state by state, and each state could, in effect, have their own law if that's what they chose to do. There is a uniform trust code basically the way that comes about is there's a national conference that puts together a proposed uniform code that they recommend that different states adopt, all with the thought of being, if we can be more uniform across the country, it's going to make it easier as people move from state to state so that the laws aren't going to be dramatically different. Then the different legislatures look at that proposed uniform code, might adopt it entirely, might change it, might not adopt any of it. But there is a uniform trust code that a number of states have looked at and have adopted in total or partially. And over the next couple days, I will make sure that I post a link to the Uniform Trust Code on the blog that you can reach from the website if you're interested in looking at that, as well as a number of states as I have adopted their various provisions. Practicing here in Michigan, as part of Michigan's probate code, we do have certain provisions in that code concerning the duties of a trustee. And I'll be posting some information on the blog as well about the Michigan code so that for those of you who are in Michigan, since that's probably most of you anyhow, might have some information about that. So those are going to be the two places where your duties are going to be defined, both in the document and under the statute that might apply to the jurisdiction that you live in. I recommend, if you have been appointed as a successor trustee, your involvement really should begin before the grantor becomes either incapacitated or passes away. I know that isn't always the case. A lot of clients that I will work with might appoint a child or children to be successor trustees, but oftentimes they don't share a lot of that information with their children beforehand. But I think it's helpful for you to have some involvement before the time arises for a number of reasons. Certainly what you want to do is you want to know where the documents are. You want to know where your parents, your grandparents, whoever it is that you're serving as a successor trustee, where do they keep their documents? Where are you going to find their trust when the time comes? It might be in a safety deposit box. It might be in a fireproof safe at home. They might have left it with the attorney, but it's important for you to try and locate the original document, not just copies. Because the problem you can run into in some of the states is if you can't find the original, there are questions that are raised with a revocable trust, and you can't find the original. Does that mean that the grantor got rid of it? Did they revoke it by throwing it away? Or had they just misplaced it? So it's important to locate where that original document is and know where to find it when the time's going to come. Also going to be important to know where are the records that the person has about their financial affairs. Hopefully they keep them all together. Hopefully they keep all of that information in the same general location as they do with their trust. But where's the information on their investments, on their life insurance policies, their bank accounts, their real estate? Where is all of that going to be located? Because that's going to be important to you when the time comes for you to serve as a trustee. So having a heads up on that, knowing where to look, if not actually having access to it, is going to be important. Now, if you have all of that information, if you know where the documents are and you know what basically the trust provides and where the information is on the finances, what that enables you to do is actually before someone was to become incapacitated or before someone was to pass away, you might have an opportunity to be involved in trying to make sure things are in order inappropriately organized before that happens. For example, when we look at that funding issue about putting assets inside the trust, what we find is oftentimes clients haven't completed all of their funding. We might have worked with them, arranged a lot of the funding, might have arranged for all the funding, but it might be that a number of years have gone by, the client has acquired new assets, maybe bought a new life insurance policy and forgot to make the trust the beneficiary, bought some new real estate, forgot to put it in the trust, for a number of reasons might not have finished that funding piece or might not have taken care of the appropriate funding with new assets. Well, if you knew, if you were looking at a situation where your parent or your grandparent or the grantor might be in a position, perhaps they have failing health, and you're concerned about that, and you're concerned about what's going to happen in the event you have to take over and manage the estate for them, it would be helpful for you to review all the funding questions beforehand, because while they still have capacity, they might be able to answer questions for you, they might be able to tell you where things are, so that you're not kind of searching without any direction in trying to find and locate information, and hopefully they might be able to be of assistance to you in whatever you need to do the funding. Obviously, in the event of a loved one who might be in a situation where death is imminent, might be in hospice, might be in the hospital, whatever the circumstances happen to be, it would be good, again, for you to review all of that funding before they actually pass away, so that if you have an opportunity to take care of any of that beforehand, then you can avoid those assets going through probate. So let's say, for example, that you're going through all of the information and you find that...
This is Dennis McKenzie.
Dennis, how are you tonight?
Very good, thank you.
Good. Tom Doyle here anyhow. We're kind of in the middle, so I'll just
okay.
Keep right on going here if I may, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that we might have as we kind of get further on. Fair enough?
Thank you.
Okay, sure. But in anticipation of a parent or a loved one dying, if you were able to go through all the documentation regarding the funding, and again, for example, perhaps you find that there's a deed that doesn't look like it's been appropriately funded into the trust, if you were able to take care of that before your parent passed away, then that would be one more asset that would be able to avoid probate. And so when I meet with prospective trustees in those circumstances, it's my recommendation that we visit the funding to make sure that all the funding has occurred, and if it hasn't occurred, see what can be done. Hopefully in that event, appropriate powers of attorney would be in place that would enable you to take care of and finish up the funding piece, or perhaps there's a spouse involved that would be able to take up the funding piece. So there are things that a successor trustee should be looking at really in advance of being called upon to serve in that capacity. Then let's say that we're dealing with a loved one who now becomes incapacitated, and you're being called upon as a successor trustee in that event to manage their estate for them. Well, first, the question's going to be, what does it mean for them to be incapacitated? Oftentimes, we're looking at trust documents that do provide something along the lines of, if I can no longer manage my affairs anymore, I designate my son to come in and serve as a successor trustee. Going to be important in that circumstance to know, when does your job begin? How do you know that the individual is incapacitated that requires your involvement? And again, that's going to be looking at the document itself to see how does the document define incapacity. It might require, for example, oftentimes two doctors to certify in writing that you can no longer handle your business affairs. If that's the case, have two doctors certify in writing that the individual can't handle their affairs anymore. If they haven't, that might be something that you're involved in. You might be the one working with the doctors and getting that certification around. Sometimes it'll only take one doctor, although in a lot of cases clients prefer to have two. I've actually, interestingly enough, and this one made no sense to me, I saw a trust that someone did before, though, that said incapacitated when a probate court determines that I'm incapacitated, which if you think about having a trust as a means to avoid probate, I don't understand why we want a probate court determining the incapacity. But you need to look at the document itself, and that's going to tell you under what circumstances you're going to be taking over that responsibility. When you take over that responsibility, you have what we generally refer to as a fiduciary duty to the grantor, the person who created the trust that you're now stepping in and managing. Your job is to manage it for their benefit. It's not to manage it for the benefit of the ultimate beneficiaries who might get it when they pass away. It's not to manage it for your own benefit, but it's stepping into their shoes, taking charge of this trust and managing it and doing what the trust requires and what the law requires that you do relative to taking care of them. That position and serving as a trustee for someone who is incapacitated is becoming more common than it used to be because, fortunately or unfortunately, many clients today are finding themselves becoming incapacitated for much longer periods of time before they would actually pass away. So your involvement at that point in time would be to take care of the assets for the individual. At the time of their death, your job kind of changes in that respect, and now your job is to take care of the assets for the benefit of the ultimate beneficiaries. If the estate is now supposed to go to the children, now your job is to basically take and manage that trust for the benefit of the children or the grandchildren or the nieces or the nephews or whoever it happens to be that this estate is trust is ultimately going to go to. So your job responsibilities shift. Again, though, it's not taking care of it for you. It's taking care of it for other, and that's where your responsibilities lie, is to the ultimate beneficiaries that were involved. Most of the time, too, these living trusts that we're talking about, they're not something that are going to be recorded with the probate court. They're not going to be something that gets recorded with the state. And so the state normally isn't involved in all of these things. It's really an arrangement where you're stepping in, a fairly private arrangement. In fact, that's one reason a lot of clients have a revocable living trust is to maintain their privacy. So there's not some government involvement. There's not some probate court oversight. It's you taking care of it, doing what you're required to do. Now, if you don't do it right, you are subject to claims of the beneficiaries, and normally it's the probate court that has jurisdiction over that. Or if in the process of you taking care of a trust, you had some particular concerns, you wanted to do something and you were concerned about other beneficiaries and what they might think about it, you also would have the right to go to the probate court and get direction from the probate court. What you're basically going to be looking at doing is you're going to be filing, at least here in Michigan, a petition with the court asking the court to review whatever this particular issue happens to be. It might be we've got some concerns about interpreting the trust. I had a case recently where the concern was whether there even was a trust or not anymore, because certain things had happened where there were some questions being raised, there were some additional documents, handwritten documents by the individual who had created the trust that seemed to be contrary to the trust document itself. And in that case, it's scheduling a hearing before a judge, notifying all the different parties of what's going on, and basically people hiring lawyers, making arguments before the judge, and then the judge is ultimately going to be the one who's going to rule, and the judge's ruling is going to control. So if the judge interprets the trust in a particular way, that's the interpretation that's going to be there. That's a little bit different than probating an estate, if you will, in the sense that to probate an estate, you have to open a probate estate. Now, what I'm not talking about, too, we're not just going to the clerk of the court. We're not just asking the clerk of the court what to do because, quite frankly, clerks of the court don't always know what to do. And secondly, the clerks of the court are not really supposed to tell anybody what to do because there are issues raised about whether or not that amounts to practicing law without a license. So when there are those issues that come about on interpreting a document, on what might happen with particular assets, those kinds of things, those are all the things that a probate court can involve itself in. It doesn't do it automatically. Probate court doesn't just come in and intervene. It's going to take some action by somebody to actually make that happen or to bring the court in anyhow. So probate court, I guess the important consideration there is that a probate court is always available under normal circumstances to be involved if there are issues that come about. Most of the time, most trusts get settled, get resolved, get finalized, get ultimately distributed without anybody having to go to the probate court. That's what happens with most of the time, but there is the probate court that's available. Now, having said that, going back to responsibilities of the trustee, duties of the trustee, whether it is serving as a successor trustee because someone has passed away, or it is serving as a successor trustee because of somebody's incapacitated, there are a number of things that you are going to be called upon to do that are basically the same. The first is to gather up all the information that there is on what the trust assets are. What does the trust own? Gather all that information together because, again, your responsibility as the trustee only extends to assets that are actually inside the trust. If there are assets that are not inside the trust, if there are assets that are passing through joint ownership or passing through some other mechanism, directly you're not involved with those assets unless you're going to attempt to make some argument and might have some argument to be made that they should have been trust assets. And that's not the normal argument that one makes. But in general, it's gathering up the assets. What does the trust have in it? Because those are the assets that you have a responsibility to maintain. Now, once you do that, now you have to protect them. You have to take appropriate steps to protect those assets. And one of the things that we find today with the volatility, if you will, in the stock market is if I have somebody coming into my office today who's serving as a successor trustee and we're looking at this trust and this trust has a significant stock portfolio, I'm going to be very concerned about what is going to be done to eliminate the downside market risk related to the stock portfolio. Because your job as trustee, assuming that it is you're being called upon to, in a fairly ordinary amount of time, to liquidate an estate, to distribute an estate out, in that case, you really have to be concerned about losing an estate. You don't want to lose the asset value, and you don't really have as a trustee, a responsibility to grow a trust, to make it bigger than it is in general. And so in that case, oftentimes, it's looking at the assets making sure that we're securing assets, we're physically securing a house, we're physically securing personal property, but these various assets and investments, et cetera, that we're taking appropriate steps, in many of those cases, it's liquidating them, selling the stock, doing it prudently, not having a fire sale, but at least doing it in an orderly fashion so that you're eliminating and minimizing the downside risk to it. So you're gathering up the assets. You're acquiring them. It might be life insurance where you're going to fill out an application for the life insurance policy to receive the benefits. Might be retirement plans. Maybe they're payable to the trust, annuities, bank accounts, whatever it happens to be, and going through that process of getting all of those assets so that they're going to be under your control and management. The second thing that you're doing in that respect that's general in both is what are the debts? Gathering information on the debts. Who does this person owe money to? Who are this person's creditors? Because if you're going to step in the event of somebody becoming incapacitated, your responsibility is going to be paying those debts out of this trust, assuming that the trust is set up to obligate debts to be paid. Your obligation in the event someone passes away is also going to be to appropriately manage the trust relative to debts. In most cases, a revocable living trust, when you look at the various laws of the state, they are not creditor avoidance tools. They're not something where you can just ignore what the person had by way of debts. As a matter of fact, in a number of the states, including Michigan, another of your responsibility is going to be to publish a notice in a newspaper that the person has passed away. In the event under Michigan law, if there is no probate estate opened, your obligation as the trustee is to publish this notice. Creditors will have 4 months to come forward and make their claims, and your obligation is actually to send a written notice to known creditors. So you have an affirmative obligation under Michigan law and under many of these other probate codes that are adopted in the other states to actually go out and look through the client's records to try and find out who did they owe money to so that we can make sure that people are appropriately being paid. So certainly in Michigan and many other states, the revocable trust, it's not a debt avoidance kind of structure. Now, you can get into some complications, if you will, if you have a probate estate and you have a trust. Let's say that you've got the trust, all the assets were not put inside the trust, there's a necessity to have a probate estate for those assets that are outside the trust. Well, if you're not the executor for the estate or the personal representative for the estate, that's not your job. That's going to be somebody else's job to go about probating those assets. Now, again, if no one does it, you might be stepping forward to make sure that it all gets done, but it can happen where you have differing responsibilities. So we're really focusing this evening on the job as the trustee, not the job as the personal representative or the administrator for an estate. Actually, one of the teleseminars that I anticipate doing down the road will focus on those responsibilities at a later date anyhow. As far as your relationship in managing these assets, if you were to look at the Uniform Trust Code, provisions under the Uniform Trust Code, if you were to look at provisions under Michigan law, if you were to look at the provisions under many other state statutes, they have a particular responsibility, a particular duty, if you will, of what we call operating as a prudent investor. You have, and in most codes, that's legally defined. What does the statute mean a prudent investor is? So it's going to be important to you when you gather up all the assets and you see what all these assets are, and you're looking at what does the trust provide. If we just have to pay the debts and distribute the estate out fairly quickly, that's one thing. If, on the other hand, we're going to have to be involved for perhaps a number of years in managing this estate, maybe we've got minor children, and we're managing the trust for these minor children, trying to get them through college, all those situations that sometimes we're dealing with, or maybe we're managing the estate for that individual who's now become incapacitated, all those things are going to factor into how and what you have to do as a prudent investor relative to these investments. Unfortunately, most lay people don't know what that obligation is, and that's certainly where professionals can come into play and can be of assistance to making sure that you're fulfilling those responsibilities to those people. In managing this trust, another obligation or responsibility that you have to look at are taxes. We have tax returns that are going to have to be prepared. As I indicated at the outset, a revocable living trust becomes irrevocable when someone passes away. When that happens, one of the things that needs to be done is someone has to obtain a new federal ID number, because normally during the person's lifetime, they simply use their Social Security. Now we're going to have to get a federal ID number. Now you're going to have certain tax obligations relative to the trust. The trust is going to have its own tax returns prepared. So those are tax obligations that have to be undertaken. There will be a final tax return that's going to be necessary for the individual who passed away. Under different circumstances, that may or may not be a responsibility that you take on. It's not technically your responsibility as a trustee, but oftentimes the person who's serving as the successor trustee is also going to arrange for the final tax return. If the estate is large enough, we're going to have federal estate tax issues that we're going to have to deal with. So if the estate is one that we've got federal estate tax returns that now have to be prepared, all of those things have to be addressed and taken care of by you as part of your responsibilities in serving as a successor trustee. There are going to be accounting responsibilities. So let's now look at between you and the beneficiaries, what are you really doing? One, most of the time, most of the probate codes that we're dealing with require you to notify and provide information to the ultimate beneficiaries of the trust. What does a trust have? How big is it? What assets does it have? So that they have some idea of what's going on. So it's normally we look at preparing what we call an inventory, similar to what we might do in a probate estate, although this isn't being filed with the probate court. An inventory, it's a list. You've gathered up all of these assets. Now you make a list of them and how much they're all worth at the time the individual passed away, if that's what we're looking at, or at the time you took over in managing this trust, if you're doing it because somebody's become incapacitated, so that you know what you started with. Where did you start? How much is all this worth? As you go through your job in managing the estate, the trust, as you pay the debts, you provide an accounting. You keep track of everything that you've done. So all the expenses that you've had, all of the income that might be coming in from various assets, you basically keep an accounting of all of that, because when you get to the end, certainly, of the ultimate trust distribution, you're going to be required to provide an accounting to the beneficiaries that demonstrates to them, here's where we started. These are the various incomes that we had, the various expenses that we have. Here's how much is left. Here's the distribution and how we've calculated that distribution. So a lot of record keeping, depending upon what sort of assets that we're looking at, is going to be involved so that you can fulfill those responsibilities adequately, so that at the end of it, everyone is satisfied that you've appropriately done your job. Now, my general recommendation to anybody that's going to serve as successor trustee that makes that responsibility a little bit easier to fulfill is I suggest go set up a new checking account, a new bank account at a new bank. Don't just keep using the checking account that maybe the grantor already had or that the trust had, but set up an entirely new account. Start with a zero balance. Use that account as your primary account that you're going to track everything through. So you're going to deposit assets inside it. You're going to be paying your debts out of that account, because that's going to make your job much easier when the time comes in providing the accountings that you're going to be providing. Now, when you have to provide the accountings, all going to be determined by perhaps the trust document itself. Sometimes trust documents are going to spell out how frequently you have to provide an accounting. Sometimes they're not going to. If they don't, then you're going to look at your state law again to determine what does your state law require by way of accountings that have to be provided to these various individuals. Under Michigan law, that accounting has to be provided at least at the point in time that you're going to be settling up the trust. Also, Michigan law requires, as appropriate, if you are requested by beneficiaries, to provide them with appropriate information to keep them apprised of what's going on in the management of the trust. It's a little bit nebulous in that respect. It doesn't say within 90 days or 180 days or anything like that. So again, that's going to be important to understand. What does the trust document say about accountings? What does your state law say about accountings? Now, interestingly too, the question that sometimes comes up is, let's say you're serving as a successor trustee for somebody who's become incapacitated. Do you have to provide accountings to the ultimate beneficiaries? In Michigan, if you are serving as a trustee in the event of an incapacity, unless the trust says something different, you don't have any obligation to provide accountings to the ultimate beneficiaries because they're not involved yet. They're only going to be involved if there's something left in the trust at the time the individual passes away. So again, different kinds of responsibilities depending upon whether you're serving as his trustee in the event of incapacity, you're serving as his trustee in the event that someone has passed away. Now, at the end of the process, in settling the trust, ultimately you're going to make distributions. You're going to distribute this trust out to those people who are entitled to receive the trust. At that point in time, different procedures for how you go about doing that. Sometimes, under certain circumstances, you're going to require that the beneficiary provide you a receipt acknowledging that they have received their distribution. We will normally do that in the matter of course because we want to make sure we don't have beneficiaries coming back later on claiming that they didn't get what they were entitled to. In some circumstances, if we can't get beneficiaries to do that, that's one of those circumstances that you could go to probate court if you wanted to get the probate court to ultimately approve the final accountings and the final distributions. That's not normally what we do, but it's certainly available in those cases where what you're really trying to make sure of is that I've done my job. I want to make sure that when my job is done and I turn this money over to these people or these assets over to these people, I don't have any ongoing concerns that somebody's going to be coming back later on claiming that I didn't appropriately do my job. So there's different kinds of ways of kind of winding up a trust in that respect. In the normal trust, when we wind up the normal trust, we normally don't provide any accountings to the probate court because, again, the probate court most of the time is not involved in these particular arrangements. You do, when serving as a trustee, unless your trust document says something different, normally have the right to be paid for what you do. So one of the things that you have to look at is how are you going to be paid for operating as a trustee of this trust? And absent something else, normally what a trust is going to say, normally what most state laws are going to say is that you're entitled to a reasonable fee. Now, that's kind of nebulous, obviously. A reasonable fee can be a different number depending upon what sort of responsibilities you've been called upon to do, how complicated has this been, how long are you involved in managing this trust, et cetera, et cetera. But you are entitled to be paid as a trustee. Now, sometimes clients will draft their documents and say, you're not getting paid. Sometimes clients will draft their documents to set a flat fee, X dollars, and they're not going to be going with some sort of a reasonable fee, which again is why we need to go back and look at the document, see what the document provides about that by way of how you're going to get paid. If it's going to be a situation where you're going to be paid a reasonable fee, then what you're going to want to do is from day one, you're going to want to track everything that you do. I recommend that to my successor trustees from day one. You track everything that you do, all the time that you spend, any expenses that you've had, although you want to pay those out of the trust. But for example, we might be making long distance phone calls on our own telephone bill, all of those sorts of expenses. You want to track all of that so that you're going to have all that information available to you as you go along in perform your responsibilities so that you can make sure that you're going to be paid for the services that you have rendered on behalf of the trust. And that gets paid, those fees get paid before the estate gets distributed out. So they're going to get paid in some sense off the top. The cost of administration are going to be paid out of that trust before the ultimate final distribution is going to be made. Having said all of that, you don't have to do it all yourself. Most states allow you to hire people to do certain things. So it's not that you have to be the lawyer, be the accountant, be the investment person. You can hire people to provide those services to you. So it's pretty common. A trustee might meet with the attorney, make a determination as to what, if it, anything, there is that they would like the attorney to be involved in. That, again, is going to play out somewhat into how complicated does it look like this matter is going to be. Certainly, if issues arise with other of the beneficiaries in the situation where litigation is going to be involved and somebody's going to be going into probate court, certainly prudence suggests that you have an attorney who knows what they're doing working with you there, and that's a cost to the trust to be paying that. Accountants, you're normally going to look at hiring the accountants to do the tax work. You don't have to do the tax work yourself. That's an administrative expense for the trust. Let them do that. Let them take on the responsibility for make sure that the final taxes for the trust are appropriately prepared, the returns are done. Investments, again, depending upon what the circumstances might be, it might be that you're going to work with the grantor's investment advisor who might have already been involved in the whole trust situation to take a look at the assets, what should be done with the investments, perhaps use them to liquidate them. On a long-term, ongoing basis, if you're going to be having this trust under your management for a period of time, let's again say we're in a position where we're doing it for minor children, can certainly be hiring investment advisors to be working with you, can hire insurance agents, can hire brokers, can hire all of these different professionals that you might need. It might be hiring appraisers to appraise real estate, might be hiring appraisers to appraise personal property. A lot of that oftentimes is really going to get determined by how complicated is the situation. Are we in a situation, for example, the easiest situation, you're the successor trustee and you're the only beneficiary. Well, I tell you what, you're not going to spend a lot of time and energy hiring different people necessarily do a lot of these things because they're not going to be necessary. Contrast that with a situation where you're a successor trustee, maybe you're dealing with a blended family. We've got stepbrothers and sisters, we've got stepparents, we've got all kinds of things involved where people have different interests in this. You might find yourself more likely to be hiring different people to be serving these different jobs to make sure that you're doing what you have to do, you're doing what you're obligated to do, and to try and minimize any of the complications that might run into in those types of situations anyhow. So it's this was not intended to be explaining every detail of everyone's responsibilities as a successor trustee, but really to give some more general overview that so that you have some sense of there are things that you can do before you actually begin serving in that capacity. There are certain things that you're going to do during it, and it's going to really take, having access to information, having access to documents, having access to professional advice as you need that professional advice to make sure that you're adequately fulfilling the responsibilities that have been called upon for you to do. Now, one final note, you don't have to serve as trustee. Someone appoints you as trustee in their documents, you can say no. So it's something that you're going to choose to do, and if you choose to do it, then you're going to be taking in all these various responsibilities for doing it. On the other hand, if you don't want to do it, for whatever reason you choose not to do it, you don't have to do it, and you've got no obligations for doing it if that's what you choose alternatively. So you do have some choices to make in the matter. No one can require you to be their trustee of their trust anyhow.